Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest, and it's an open forum. You are welcome to call if you have a question. 888-318-7884. Anybody welcome to call. 888-318-7884. Jimmy, of course, author of lots of great books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, A Daily Defense, 365 Days, Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness, and Where to Find It. And if you've got a question for Jimmy, you're welcome here. 888-31-TRUTH. And as many people do, you may also know Jimmy from his podcast, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the well-named Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. I don't think, Jimmy, when I travel, I don't think I ever go anywhere where somebody doesn't ask me about Jimmy Akin and Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. It's very popular. Yeah, people really like it.
Yeah. I have a lot of fun doing it.
Uh-huh. And it's that, you know, you were just, an earlier answer, I don't remember what you were answering, but part of the answer was critical thinking, being reasonable. That's your thing.
that was the question about exorcists.
Oh, yeah.
What exorcists say. And I was happy to have that question because I see a lot of people in like comm boxes on YouTube and other places just saying, well, what would an exorcist say about this? As if exorcists were omniscient super geniuses without having to study a subject.
No, those are radio hosts.
I know. One must have one's little joke, mustn't one sigh.
No, I don't like being addressed as one. That's not a good sign when I'm being addressed as one must.
We're joking around.
I like the image of them as bouncers as well.
Yeah.
Spiritual bouncers.
There is, unfortunately, sort of two problems here. One is there's an undue deference to exorcists that attributes to them an accuracy and an infallibility that they really don't have. And secondly, that there's a lack of recognition of just how much they disagree with each other.
Yeah.
They're all over the map on their theories of possession and why it happens and their theories of exorcism and how it works and their theories of demons. It's just they're just all over the place on bunches of these subjects. And it really, when you start studying it, and there are different opinions being expressed today than have been expressed historically. I've run into multiple things that I've heard exorcists saying today that have no history in the history of exorcism, because I've been studying the history of exorcism. And there's a lot of new stuff that gets repeated as kind of part of it's like the apparition rumor net. There's a sort of exorcist rumor net where an idea gets popular among one exorcist or a few exorcists, and they rush it out and they present it to the public as if it's true, as opposed to an opinion. And they don't really often give good evidence. I mean, sometimes the evidence they give is terrible. Like, a demon told me this during an exorcism. It's like, he's working for the father of lies.
Yeah,
I know. You shouldn't be citing what a demon told you as evidence.
Yeah, that's like trusting the mafia when they tell you there's no mafia. Yeah. all right. Yeah, this is an interested party. Oh, I apologize to the mafia, by the way. I don't need any more enemies. Tony's in Anaheim, California, watching on YouTube. Tony, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Let me get direct to the issue, going back to the issue of free will.
Okay.
Now, I have a classmate who was pastor, and he posted something on the Viber that God changes his mind. And I was just reading way back from Catholic Answer Focus that Jimmy said, no, God does not change his mind. He is not in space or time, and therefore unchangeable. So my question is, but we humans are given free will. So are the results of our free will predestined? In other words, is it just like, okay, you have free will, you either choose A, B, C, D. If you choose A, this is what you're going to get, and B, this is what you're going to get. So basically, God knows all the answers to those. So how do we know whether we're going up, down, or in the middle, purgatory?
Okay.
So if you're asking, are the results of our free will choices predestined? The answer is going to depend on what you mean by predestined. If all you mean is, does God know what we're going to freely choose to do in the future, let's say, the answer is yes. He knows what we're going to freely choose to do in the future. And if that's all you mean by predestined, just that God knows this is going to happen, then yeah, they are predestined in that sense. Although you might want to use another term like foreknown, you know, meaning just known ahead of time. To describe that rather than predestined. If you use the term predestined, to many people that means destined ahead of time, like by God or by fate or something like that. Well, there is no fate apart from God. So fate does not determine our choices. They're free. If you mean, does God determine our choices ahead of time, then there are some people who are Christian and Catholic who would say yes. Followers of St. Thomas Aquinas would say that God chooses what we're going to do in the future and affects our will in such a way that we end up making the choice that he has determined that we will make. The problem for this view is it's hard to see how what Thomists are describing is actually free. It looks like we're robots and God's just programming us. And so a challenge for Thomism is how can you meaningfully describe this as free will if God's affecting our wills so that we make the choices that he determines us to make? Then there is another school known as Molinism. And Molinism says that God knows what we will freely choose to do if we're put in certain circumstances. And he then puts us into the circumstances where he knows we will freely choose, let's say, to follow him. And so he's not directly acting on our will, but he's putting our will in circumstances that he knows what we're going to freely choose. There are also problems for this view, and they get kind of complex. One of them is it's not clear that there are always circumstances that will result in us freely to choose one thing or another. Another major, major problem with this is if we don't, how would God know what we're going to choose in a given circumstance if the choice is really free, meaning not determined by other factors? And so there are also problems with this. And then there are people who would say God doesn't choose our individual choices, that both the Thomists are wrong and the Molinists are wrong. God gives us his grace and he knows what we will choose, but he doesn't determine what we will choose. He doesn't decide this person's going to heaven and this person's not going to heaven. He gives everybody his grace and he knows if we're going to respond to it or not, but he's not assigning us destinies to heaven or hell just based on his own choice. He sees what we do and then says, okay, this person has responded to my grace. They're dying in a state of grace, so they go to heaven. And they're predestined in that sense. So in the other question, Tony, that you asked was, how do we know what our final fate is going to be? And the answer is, well, we don't know for certain, but we do have evidence. The New Testament, particularly 1 John, presents us with tests that we can use to see, are we living in the love of God? Do we love our brothers and things like our brother Christians? And if we are living lives of Christian love, then that's evidence we are in a state of grace and will go to heaven. It's not infallible certitude that that's the case, but basically, you know, do an examination of conscience. If you're living a life where you are consistently in a state of grace and living a life of Christian love and not committing mortal sins, then that's good evidence that you're going to end up going to heaven. Even if it means you get cleaned up in purgatory first, you would ultimately be going to heaven. On the other hand, if you look at your life and say, you know, I'm just constantly in a state of mortal sin and I don't really I don't really love God or love my brother. I just want to be selfish and do things for me exclusively. You know, I don't really want to be with God. I don't want to really be in heaven. I just want to do my thing. I just want to commit adultery, if that's what your thing is. Well, then you've got reason to question whether you're going to go to heaven, and you would want to repent.
And I got to leave it there because we got to go to the break. But what a great call and a question. Thank you very, very much for that, Tony. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I don't like looking back. I prefer to look forward and keep moving forward. There's plenty to cover. I do a lot of research and try to dig out the bits and pieces of a life or of an agenda that people don't want to talk about.
The World Over with Raymond Arroyo. Tonight, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Happy Advent to you. I hope Advent is progressing well for you. It's Open Forum today. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Open Forum means open to anyone. And you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Kay's in Maine watching on YouTube. Kay, we're glad you called. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Jimmy, I have one of my coworkers. She is Wiccan.
Uh-huh.
Her granddaughter is 16, and she wants to know about God. And my coworker has asked me to help her granddaughter, so she's given me permission to talk to her.
Good.
I don't know where to start.
Okay. Well, I would, in terms of how to begin the conversation, you know, I'd say, hey, so what prompted your interest in learning about God? And listen to what she had to say, and then respond to what she has to say. Eventually, you know, and so I always, in talking to people who are wanting to learn about a subject, I try to begin by asking questions so that I better understand their position and where they're coming from so I can serve them better rather than just barreling ahead with a presentation on a topic. I want to make them feel like I really do get where they're coming from and I care about them and I want to serve them, and because all those things are true. I'm not interested in just delivering a speech. I want to understand the person I'm working with so I can help them. And I want them to understand that that's my attitude and that's what I care about them as an individual, and I'm interested in them as an individual even if I've never met them before. I want them to understand that I take them seriously as a person and I respect them and care about them. In terms of the content, well, if they say they want to know about God, I would explain that, okay, Christianity and Judaism and other major religions believe that we see a lot of different phenomena in the world, and we've discovered that a lot of these phenomena are tied together in various ways, such as by the laws of nature. You know, there's a reason that the hydrological cycle works, that, you know, rain falls down and then it evaporates, goes back up to the clouds, and then it falls back down again, you know, and there are laws that we can study that govern that. But that then raises the question, well, where did the matter come from that the rain is made of? And where did the laws come from that the rain obeys? And there is a profound intuition on the part of humans that it must go back to some original source. And some humans in history have proposed, you know, gods to explain the, you know, where the world came from and why it works the way it does. But if you stop there, and Wicca actually kind of does stop there. Wicca, for people who may not be aware, is a modern religion. It does not actually go back in history beyond, you know, much more than a century. And it's dietheistic, meaning it believes in two gods. They're called the goddess and the horned god, and they're both like nature spirits. But you then have a question. Okay, if you're trying to explain the world and where it came from, and you say there are these gods in it, whether it's two gods or more than two gods, those gods have to exist in some kind of framework. You know, they have to exist in God space or something, you know, something that unites them and allows them to work together. And so where did God space come from? It looks like we, you know, what made the, what, you know, where did all this come from, and how does it, what established the rules by which it works? And so there's an intuition that behind any lesser spirits, which you can either call gods or angels or whatever you want, behind any lesser spirits that are involved in the operation of the world, there must ultimately be a single common source, a single original great God that made everything else and established the rules for everything else. And that's actually believed by a lot of different cultures around the world. Even if they have smaller gods that they interact with, they'll typically say, yeah, there's a big one too, who's behind everything, who's behind the smaller spirits. And the claim of Judaism and Christianity is that single great God that's behind everything has taken an interest in us, and he loves us just like he loves the rest of his creation, and he's made contact with us, since unlike some parts of his creation, you know, like rocks, you know, or bacteria, they don't really have the ability to understand God, but he made us so that we do have the ability to understand God, and consequently he's reached out to us and he's told us about himself, and there's a whole history of God's interaction with mankind, starting, you know, with the Jewish people and broadening out to include people from all different cultures through Jesus Christ, who's the universal savior of mankind.
Okay, that all work?
Yeah, it does. It's great. Thank you so very much.
No prayers problem. For you.
Yeah, and if you want, feel free to, if you think it would help, you know, feel free to play her a clip where I explain all that if you think that would benefit her. But good luck to you and to her in helping her explore this very important subject.
Thank you, Kay. Thank you very, very much for the call. Jennifer's in New Jersey listening on Domestic Church Media. Jennifer, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you so much, and thank you both for the beautiful work that you do for the church.
Thank you, Jennifer.
I'm actually calling it. Absolutely. I'm actually calling to get some information for my dad. He's reading a book mm-hmm. called Christmas, a Biography by Judith Flanders, who we're pretty mm-hmm. sure is not a Catholic author. And she's claiming that there would not have been a census at the time of the birth mm-hmm. of Christ, and that even if there were, that Mary and Joseph would not have had to journey to Bethlehem. So we weren't quite sure how to, you know, to respond to that claim.
Yeah, so you sometimes hear this, and there are frankly a bunch of problems with this claim. One of them is we're dealing with incomplete knowledge. We do not have an exhaustive record of all of the censuses that the Romans conducted in this period. I mean, we don't have any Roman administrative records. You know, it's not like we have all of the orders that Caesar Augustus gave. You know, they presume there may have been an archive of such records, but it doesn't exist anymore. So we're dealing with incomplete knowledge. Another problem with this claim is the people who make it usually are using the wrong date for Jesus's birth. The people who make this claim commonly date his birth to like 6 or 7 BC. And And actually, the evidence indicates he wasn't born then. He was born in 3 or 2 BC. Then there's a problem that they're thinking only in terms of a census. And that's not actually what Luke says when he talks about this. There is a word for census. The word happens to be census, at least in Latin. But that's not what Luke says. Instead, he says that a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that the whole world should be enrolled. And you can enroll people for taking a census just to count your population, or you can enroll them for purposes of taxation, which is what a lot of people think, speculate this enrollment may have been, or you can enroll them for other purposes, like loyalty. And in fact, we've actually got evidence that there was such an enrollment for loyalty purposes in 3 or 2 BC. Caesar Augustus himself, one of the things we do have, we don't have his administrative acts, but we do have a monument called the act, an inscription on a monument. The inscription is called the Acts of the Divine Augustus, and it lists accomplishments that he had during his career. And he wrote it himself. It's all first person. I did this and I did this and this happened and so forth. And he says that in 3/2 BC, the equestrian order and the whole people of Rome gave him the title Father of the Country. And so this was a kind of loyalty thing where they're declaring him, you're our political father. And we have evidence suggesting that this was taken by the entire people of the Roman Empire, not just in Rome itself, but including Jews, because the Jewish historian Josephus mentions that there were 6,000 Pharisees who refused to do this. And the implication is the other Jews were willing to do it. And so so it's quite possible that what we're looking at here is not a census or a tax census, but a loyalty enrollment, and where people were swearing their loyalty to Augustus as their leader. And we know that happened in 3/2 BC, which is the year the evidence points to Christ being born in. So that may be what we're talking about here. There's more I can say about this, but I'll recommend a resource that I actually wrote that is online that you can check out and share with your father. It's called The Enrollment of Jesus's Birth. And one way you can get there is by Googling my name, Jimmy Akin, A-K-I-N, and The Enrollment of Jesus's Birth. And it should come up. You also can get there by going to jimmyakin.com/BART, B-A-R-T. That when you go to jimmyakin.com/BART, you'll find a set of resources that I prepared when I was having a debate with a skeptical scholar named Bart Ehrman. And if you scroll down on that page, one of the resources that's linked there is The Enrollment of Jesus's Birth, which is the one that you would be most interested in.
Jennifer, thank you very much for the question. I hope that was helpful to you. I hope you will find that. I'm going to keep moving because the lines continue full. Martin is in Riverside, California, watching on Facebook. Martin, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy.
Hey. What's your question, Martin?
Hey, so my specific question would be, where does the Catholic Church stand in regard to plastic surgery? Because I know, without getting too analytical in regard to the certain procedures that take place, is there a certain place that the Catholic Church kind of stands firm on?
Well, I'm not aware of any magisterial statements on the subject of plastic surgery. There may have been some. One area that I could imagine there being some statements on is on reconstructive surgery. Like if someone's been in a horrible accident and let's say their face has been completely messed up, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find a statement somewhere mentioning the praiseworthiness of doctors doing reconstructive surgery to help people who've been disfigured by accident or similar things. Fundamentally, though, and this apart from such statements, this wouldn't be a matter of church teaching, but in terms of Catholic moral theology, the standard opinion would be that there's no problem in principle with plastic surgery. You can do, for example, reconstructive surgery to help people live a normal life after a terrible accident. What about plastic surgery in other situations? Well, sometimes there are health problems that people have that can require plastic surgery, and it's okay in those situations. What about if you just want to look better? Well, there's nothing wrong with wanting to look better. So if you want to get a minor change made so that you look better, that's okay. On the other hand, can you become obsessive about it? Yes. Can you spend vast sums of money on it that are better spent on something else? Yes. So it's not always right, but it's not always wrong either.
Martin, thank you very, very much for the call and the question. We continue with Open Forum right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Divine Mercy Messages is the challenge for the Take-Two family in 2024.
That's tomorrow on Take-Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live with Cy Kellett.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Lines have been pretty full today. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's hard to believe we've been doing this for 90 minutes already. Time's just flown by.
It has just flown by.
That's what happens when people call in with interesting questions.
Interesting questions that people got to. That's what I'm going to say. I'm going to sum up today that way. It does feel like it went fast.
For point of fact, you know, some people will say, "Oh, that's a good question," or something. I never use that phrase, or at least I don't accept by mistake, because I think all questions are good. All questions are legitimate to ask, and therefore they're good in that sense. The trick is giving them a good answer. Yeah. But some good questions are more interesting to the person answering them or the person listening to the answer than others. And today we've got a bunch of interesting questions.
Let's see about Jen in Cincinnati. All right, that's a lot of pressure. After that little discursus, Jen, that's a lot of pressure on you.
Listening
on Sacred Heart Radio.
Here. Don't pressure the listeners, Sy.
Okay, good point. All right. Go ahead, Jen, with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. My question is about an approach to receiving the Eucharist. Is it better to abstain from the Eucharist unless you're certain that you're in a state of grace in order to avoid receiving unworthily, or is it better to avoid only when you're certain of mortal sin because of the sanctifying grace that we receive?
So Jesus, instituted this rite to be used, and we have evidence from the New Testament that indicates that it was broadly received. It wasn't just the priest who received communion at Mass, it was the people as well. And what we find, if we look, for example, at 1 Corinthians, especially chapters 10 and 11, where Paul deals with this, there's an expectation that Christians will receive communion at Mass unless they are unworthy to do so. And Paul says that people should examine themselves and see if they're receiving communion worthily or not. But the expectation is unless you are in a state where you're not worthy to receive it, you go ahead and receive it. So that's the default. The default is that you receive communion unless you have reason to think that you shouldn't. And how strong does that reason need to be? Well, it's going to depend a little bit on your state of conscience. There are, you can broadly classify people into three different states with regarding their conscience. There are those who have a lax conscience, those who have a healthy conscience, and those who have a scrupulous conscience. People who have a lax conscience are those who don't really morally reflect on their actions, and they just tend to assume, yeah, I'm okay. Well, okay, if someone has a lax conscience, then that's exactly the person Paul's talking to and say, hey, you better examine yourself before you receive communion. Yeah. If someone has a healthy conscience and you think there is a strong chance that you have an unconfessed mortal sin, then you should refrain until you can go to confession. On the other hand, then there are people with a scrupulous conscience. People with a scrupulous conscience are terrified that they are always in a state of mortal sin, even over very small things. This state of scrupulosity is also associated with what's known as obsessive compulsive disorder, which is where a person has a psychological condition that gives them painful, distressing thoughts, which they don't want, because the OCD wants them to be in pain. That's why the OCD does this. And in religious people, one of the most painful kinds of thoughts you can have is like hostile thoughts about God or other sinful thoughts. And so the OCD will give the person these hostile thoughts or sinful thoughts in order to torture the person. But the thing is, these thoughts are not things the person is willing. The person doesn't agree with these thoughts. That's why they find them painful. The fact they find them painful is itself a sign they don't agree with them. So these thoughts are what psychologists refer to as ego dystonic. They're not in agreement with your ego, with your fundamental self. And so because they're ego dystonic, they're not mortal sins. And so what the standard advice is, and this has been true for centuries, if you've got a scrupulous person, then they are to receive communion unless they are certain that they are in a state of mortal sin. Now, if you've got a healthy conscience, if you've got just significant evidence that you may have committed a mortal sin you haven't confessed, well, if you've got significant evidence of a mortal sin, then go to confession first. But if you're scrupulous, do not confess things unless you're sure it was a mortal sin, meaning certain, and do not stop yourself from receiving communion unless you're certain that you have an unconfessed mortal sin. So the pastoral approach depends on the state of the person's conscience, but the default is go to communion based on the New Testament practice, is go to communion unless you have reason not to.
All right.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, Jen, thank you very, very much. Appreciate the call. The number's 888-318-7884. We got time to take another call before we have to do any breaks. So off we go to Salem, Oregon. Ed is in Salem. Thank you, Ed, for the call. Go ahead with the question.
Yes, Jimmy. I really admire your work. I haven't read any of your books, but I want to. I'm really interested in the early church fathers, and I understand that you've read or written extensively about the early church fathers. And I would recommend, I would ask for your recommendations on which ones to read, or which one to read, so I can become familiar and really get involved in it.
Well, if you're interested in understanding the church fathers generally, then I wouldn't recommend you focus on just one father, because reading one father will give you a knowledge of what that father said, but it won't give you a broader knowledge. I'll recommend two things as kind of ways to get started. The first one is a book called, it's published by Penguin Books. The editor is a guy named Maxwell Staniforth. Staniforth, Maxwell Staniforth. And the book is called Early Christian Writings. And this contains a selection, it's not all of them, but it contains a selection of writings from the apostolic and post-apostolic age. So basically, the first century and the second century. Now, it doesn't include everything, but it does include a broad selection of what some of the earliest fathers were saying, and it's an easy-to-read book, and I read it many years ago. In fact, it was one of the books that helped in my own journey towards becoming Catholic, because I read it, and I said, wow, these guys don't sound Protestant, and they're the earliest Christians we have outside the New Testament. So I'd recommend Early Christian Writings, edited by Maxwell Staniforth. Also, to give you a broad selection, I'd recommend the main thing that I wrote, which is a book called The Fathers Know Best. And it surveys what the fathers taught on different topics. It also has a kind of historical overview of who the fathers were and where they were from and things like that. And it shows you in chronological order how their thought developed on particular topics and how it's in continuity with the teaching of the Catholic Church today. And since we published that one, we can just send it to you since you're here in the United States. So, Ed, if you're able to hang on the line, we'll take your address and send you a copy of The Fathers Know Best.
Thanks, Ed. Just hang on. Edgar will pick up the line, and we'll take a quick break. We'll come back with more questions for Jimmy Akin. Boy, the lines have been nicely full today. Sense of prosperity on the lines today. We'll take advantage of that when we come back on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, when we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue. Her remedy? Works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
This is Sister Lucia Traynor of the Franciscan Sisters of the Eucharist. Catholic Radio is an apostolate that is immediate, interactive, effective, and worldwide. It stimulates listeners to follow the teachings of the Church, brings Scripture closer to us, helps those who wrestle with questions of conscience, and allows us to celebrate the joy of our faith every day.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Darren mentioned Shark Week at the break. It's so long till Shark Week. I don't know how I'm going to make it now that you brought it up, Darren. I'm just going to have to. Well, maybe I've still got last year's Shark Week recorded, so I can check in on that. Let's see. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Thursday. We've had some groovy music. It's an awful good day. And now we've got Mark from Rhode Island, which I assume is going to be another fun and exciting call. Mark, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. God bless you all.
You too. Thank you, Mark.
You know, the final caller on yesterday's show said some things about Pope Francis that really bothered me.
Okay.
And I think we have a loud minority of people saying such things. I feel like too many Catholics are just assuming Pope Francis is worthy of harsh criticism because they've fallen for rash, uncharitable slander, Protestant propaganda, and Sidi Vacantist smear campaigns. And I recommend everyone who's eager to criticize Pope Francis to challenge themselves by listening to Michael Lofton's Defense of the Holy Father on his Reason and Theology YouTube channel. It appears to me that Pope Francis has defended the deposit of faith while also reaching out to sinners.
My Mark, good, because I'm not sensing your question yet.
All right, here we go, Mark. Go ahead with the question.
I just wanted to introduce it, but my question is, what has Pope Francis done that's so objectionable? And why do you think there aren't more Catholics willing to stand up against the slander instead of just going along with it or staying silent?
All right. Thank you, Mark.
Well, I think that so there's a couple questions there. The first is, what has Pope Francis done? And the second is, why aren't there more Catholics defending him? In terms of the first one, I think that the answer is going to depend on the individual. Different individuals are critical of Pope Francis for different things, just like any pope. And so I think if you asked people who are his critics, well, why, what has he done that has prompted you to become publicly critical of him, I think the answer would vary from one person to another. I think that there would be certain themes that would come up in the responses, that there would be certain responses that are more common than others. Some people might point towards confusing things that he said in interviews on airplanes. You know, that was something that was at kind of some of the beginning of the criticism of Pope Francis early in his papacy. Other people would cite more recent things, like his restrictions on the celebration of the Tridentine form of the liturgy. Other people would cite things that he himself didn't do, but that were kind of done on his watch, like the Pachamama figurine that was used at the Amazonian Synod of Bishops. Other people would point to Amoris Laetitiae and what it does or doesn't imply about the ability to receive communion in irregular marital situations. Other people would point to, his, and I'm not saying I agree with all these charges. I'm just saying I'm answering. These are what you would hear from various people if you asked them who are critical of Pope Francis. Some people would say, I'm really scared about the future and what he's going to do to Catholic doctrine based on the way he tolerates apparent dissent from people like the German bishops, but then he harshly cracks down on people who are more conservative, and they're concerned about what could happen in the future. So I think that you'd have a variety of different sources of criticism that, or things that people would cite if you asked them, why have you become a public critic of Francis? But I think those would probably be some of the key themes that they would answer if you took a survey of such people. In terms of why aren't there more people defending him? Well, this is one of those. This is a question that actually comes up fairly frequently on the show, at least in form, not this specific question, but lots of people call in and say, why doesn't X happen more than it does? You know, and they'll fill in X with some thing like, you know, why aren't Catholics more pro-life than they are? Or why aren't the bishops doing more about immigration than they are, or whatever it may be? And the answer is, well, they're people, and they're going to have different answers to that question, just like the critics are going to have different answers. The potential defenders are going to have different answers. Some of them, a lot of people, don't really have a public platform, you know, and would say, well, I defend Pope Francis among my friends, but I'm not a big YouTuber or, you know, podcaster. I don't have the reach to have a major public voice on this issue. I just do what I can in my own circle. Others would say, you know, I've tried to defend Pope Francis and it hasn't satisfied the critics. You know, I'll be having a discussion on Facebook and someone will say something really critical of Pope Francis and I respond and they just don't care. They just barrel on, you know. So some people would say I got discouraged because the critics are so harsh and seemingly unreasonable. Other people would say, I defend him. I will defend him on major things, but I think there's some legitimate criticism on some other things, and I'm not going to defend him when I think something's illegitimate. Other people would say, I'm happy to defend him, but I can't get involved in every single thing. You know, I would spend nothing but rebutting Francis critics if I felt the need to respond to every single thing. So I will respond when something's major, but I'm not going to go after every Francis criticism. And other people would say, it's just not my calling. I have other things to do in life. You know, some people may be called to be Francis defenders, and that's great and more power to them. But that's not my calling. I'm called to do other things. And if I devoted, time to this one, it would become a time suck. And it could even harm my ability to be effective in other areas. If people just thought, oh, here's that Francis defender again, you know, and I became too associated with this. I need to preserve my ability to do good in other areas because not everything in life is about Pope Francis. So I think that that's what I could tell you. I think the answers for the critics are going to vary, and I think the answers for the possible defenders are going to vary because people are different and they're going to have different reasons why they're critical and different reasons why they do or don't defend.
Mark?
Sounds good. The Pastor Mama thing was a big misunderstanding. I love Pope Francis and I love Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Keep on going, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
And I agree. I think the Pachamama thing was a big misunderstanding. Yeah.
Appreciate the call. And I have to agree. I love Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So there you got two agreements to your two things.
Just not me.
Wait, you're not a misunderstanding, is it?
No.
All right.
I'm messing with you. Don't worry.
Joe is in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. Joe, thanks very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. I was wondering, could your doxastic damage theory of lying be used as a legitimate rebuttal to the assertion I've heard that Jesus lied to the brethren, or at least deceived them, in John chapter 7, verses 8 and 9, when he said he was not going up to the festival, and then when they left, he immediately went up to the festival.
Yeah, so what Jesus says, this is John 7, and Jesus's brothers, who don't believe in him at this point, urge him to go up to the Feast of Tabernacles in Jerusalem. And they say to him, depart from here and go to Judea so your disciples can see your works that you were doing, for no one does anything in secret, and yet he himself desires to be publicly recognized. If you are doing these things, reveal yourself to the world. And so they're encouraging him to go make a big public spectacle of himself at the Feast of Tabernacles. But Jesus responds with, my time is not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its deeds are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast because my time is not yet complete. And yet he then does go up to the feast. So there's a question about what's going on here. Now, some versions of the Bible, some manuscripts actually have an insertion in this verse where he says, I am not yet going up to this feast. But most scholars think that that's a later insertion, because it's easy to see how someone could add that to try to smooth this over and ease the cognitive dissonance we have when reading this. It's like, why is he saying he's not going to go when he does? So most scholars think that's an addition. In which case, if it is, then we have a puzzle. Why does he say he's not going to go when he does go? And different theories of lying and deception could account for that. Now, I should mention that it may not involve lying and deception. Someone could say, well, he wasn't planning to go, and then he just changed his mind. So he wasn't deceiving them. He just wasn't planning to go at that point. And then he changed his mind and he went. Another possibility is to say, well, he was using a mental reservation. And a mental reservation is a kind of a deception, but it's not a lie. He didn't actually say anything false if he was interpreting this in some other way that they didn't understand. On the other hand, it kind of looks like it's a lie, because he says, I'm not going, and then he goes. So if that's a lie, then could the doxastic damage theory that I have proposed account for it? And I want to say, this is just my proposal. This is my theory of lying. So it's just my opinion. My opinion is that lying does a form of damage to a person's belief system. Like punching someone in the nose does damage to their body. It does physical damage. Lying to someone does damage to their beliefs. It's what in philosophy is known as doxastic damage. Doxastic is a fancy word, means connected with belief. And so if I lie to someone, I'm damaging their belief system. Well, there are situations where doing physical damage to a person is legitimate. You know, I can punch someone if they're about to attack me. I can defend myself. And in the same way, there can be situations where damaging someone's belief could be preferable to other options, like the classic Nazis at the door. Well, I could kill the Nazis at the door to keep them from keep them from kidnapping Jews that I'm hiding. But that has a whole, if I start killing Nazis when they come to my door, that's going to not end well for me or the Jews I'm sheltering. So if I could be legitimate in killing the Nazis to protect Jewish lives, I would also seem to be able to just lie to the Nazis in order to protect Jewish lives, which will actually protect the Jews I'm hiding better than if I kill the Nazis. So I think there are situations that where doing doxastic damage to someone could be legitimate. And I could imagine that principle being applied in this situation. So what Jesus's brothers are intending to do is have him make a big public spectacle where he shows himself to the world and people are all excited about his miracles and stuff like that. And he's saying, hey, my time for that's not yet come. So imagine if he had said, yeah, I'm going to go up to this festival. Then they presumably would have stirred everybody up when they got there. They would say, guess what? Our brother's coming and he's going to do great miracles and everyone needs to go watch him. And he's going to make this big public demonstration of who he is and so forth. And that could have interfered with Jesus's actual plans. If his brothers were going up to the festival and hyping expectations about what Jesus was going to do there when Jesus was not planning on doing those things. And so it could be reasonable to just say, you know, you guys go, I'm not going, you know, at least now I'm not saying that's what I think explains this passage. I think this is a challenging passage that can have multiple different explanations. But if you're asking the question, could the doxastic damage theory of lying be applied to this passage, then yes, I think it could be applied. I'm not saying I would think that's automatically the correct solution for this passage, but it could be applied.
And that brings us right to the end of the program. Thank you very, very much for the call and for the question, Joe. Thanks to everybody who called. Just a few left on the line, and I apologize to you, but we keep doing this week after week. Call again. We'll do our very best to get you on with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, thanks very much. I enjoyed those 2 hours. They really did go quickly.
Me too. It was great. Look forward to next time, which is like tomorrow in a wibbly wobbly timey wimey way.
Jimmy will be back. 2 hours of open forum tomorrow. All right. We'll see you then. By the way, we're going to Canada on a cruise, Catholic Answers Cruise, coming June 29th through July 6th, departing from Montreal. If you want to join us, check out CatholicAnswersCruise.com and use the promo code NL150 to get your discount. See you next time, God willing, right here, Catholic Answers Live.